Once, not so very long ago, the people of the world were saying,
airplanes, huh. Why, it's against the Creator's will. If the Creator wanted us to fly, he'd have given us wings.
But we fly. Maybe some of you may still remember an even sillier remark.
Automobiles? Bah. They scare the hosses. If the Creator had meant for us to roll around the countryside, we'd have been born with wheels.
Silly? Certainly. We were not born with wings. We were not born with wheels. But in the modern world of today, it's an accepted fact that we must have them. So we have corrected that which nature has not given us. Strangely enough, nature has given us all these things. We just had to learn how to put nature's elements together for our use, that's all. Yet, the world is shocked by a sex change.
If the Creator had wanted us to fly, he'd have given us wings. Hey, where's my jet?
Content warning for discussion of transphobia, including transphobic laws, harassment, and violence, as well as internalized transphobia and suicidality. Take care.
Kia ora, welcome comrades to Where's My Jetpack, a politics and pop culture podcast with sci-fi and socialist leanings. Apologies for a bit of a slow start to the year, we've had some personal circumstances which have slowed things down a bit, but for Pride Month, along with our interview with Filipino comrade about LGBT rights in the Philippines, we've also got this discussion between two gender diverse hosts on trans rights. There's me, Ani, and Lydia Gregorut is a wage slave and mischief maker from God knows where. She tries to spend her time creating music and hopes to one day be an exalted metaphysician. She also does a bunch of editing for us, so congratulate her on the better edited episodes of our podcast. So welcome to the show, Lydia.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on. And I was just thinking about those two lines about my life, about how I hope to one day be an exalted metaphysician. And yeah, that's just such a true thing. I don't think that you could like sum me up in a couple of sentences better than that. So kudos to me for doing that and being able to sum my own life up really well.
Yeah, I think that probably applies to me too. I mean, I am a Marxist in media studies. I feel like ultimately, at some point, that has to transcend to metaphysics, doesn't it? Or you're not really doing it right.
There's probably a pipeline, but it's more like there's an express train to there, and you get a ticket to there if you want it.
I'm sure some people would already pejoratively accuse us of metaphysics, but really, we're not quite there yet. We're heading in that direction.
I would absolutely wholeheartedly embrace it. I'd be like, hell yeah, metaphysics is important. Let's talk about ontology for a bit.
Well, every so often I get accused of being either a trot or an anarchist, and I'm like, well, that's half right, I guess. It's not really, neither is really exactly true, but I'm happy to accept the labels.
That's similar with me too.
Usually if someone's accusing you negatively of being one of those two things, it's mostly a bad sign about their politics.
Yeah, totally. I always feel really like poised to defend Trotskyism and anarchism as well. Whenever people call me that pejoratively, I'm like, hey, you know, like, those guys aren't like that bad. Have you looked at yourself in the mirror lately? You got some real funny types hanging around.
Yes. So beyond the banter, which I'm told people don't like banter. Apparently, they want. What's that?
People don't like banter.
That's what I'm told. I've had complaints from friends about banter and podcasts in general. They want to go straight into the content, which I think may not be representative of audiences in general so much as the sort of people who are on my friends list. But anyway, no offense to anyone listening. So for people who aren't familiar, this is a very broad question, but what does it mean to be trans today?
Well, that's a very broad question.
Yes.
Obviously, it's like a leading question. You can't really have a very simple answer for it. But you have to kind of define what it means to be trans at all, first of all, which is, I guess, kind of in a modern context anyway. So the two concepts kind of kind of reinforcing each other's definitions. So being trans today is being kind of trans at all, really. But yeah, basically it means to be kind of living in a time where you are not living the same sort of life as cisgender people, basically, in a nutshell. But, you know, that means a lot of different things. So you'll come up against a lot of kind of rules and norms in life that you won't be able to deal with as easy as someone who, you know, doesn't have to go through a gender transition. Legal things, discrimination, issues that happen. I mean, what do you think it means to be trans?
What do I think it means to be trans? I think it's, I'll get really nerdy. I think it's almost, much like homosexuality, it's almost something that is a very modern transformation of things that have existed for a long time. I mean, the strictest definition is your gender identity conflicts with your gender assigned at birth. That's very much a kind of a medical and a modern definition. I mean, the whole idea of identity in part is a very modern Western thing, and then the whole idea of assigned at birth very much refers to the contemporary medical system. You know, it's the medical system that assigns people a gender. There's various forms of gender diversity that have existed throughout history, basically. So, you know, there's, for example, you know, in the Pacific, you have whawhawhene. That can be understood as kind of similar to being a trans woman. It's not necessarily where your gender conflicts with your gender assigned as birth. Often people have been raised as whawhawhene. So in that sense, it's not exactly the same thing. There's many forms of gender diversity like that, but essentially, I'd very much recommend Leslie Feinberg's Transgender Warriors for the sort of the history of all of this. But basically, through the development of like private property and inheritance, which basically developed a very patriarchal gender binary, and the modicum medical system, that's kind of come to define contemporary transness in a sense. That transness has to be asserted against those things, the kind of enforced Christian gender binary as well as the medical system. But we'll get into more of the really contemporary concrete sort of manifestations of it from here. Like, what does it mean to be the today part? Because that's not just today since the 19th century, it's today in 2022. So we'll be talking about that from here. But yeah, it's a very broad question with many possible answers. Just giving people a general idea in case they're not sort of familiar with all of that. Yeah, so to get to the current stuff, what are the key policy issues facing trans people?
Because of like what you said, that trans people are very medicalized in a modern context, that it's a, you know, an issue of identity and stuff like that, a legal issue in a lot of ways for us. So, you know, a lot of these issues are policy issues, whether someone's going to legally prosecute you for being in the right bathroom of your, you know, your actual gender, stuff like that. So bathroom bills is something we see come up, like sporting. So whether or not trans people should be able to compete in sports at school level or at, you know, the professional level. We've seen professional athletes like Leah Thomas and Laurel Hubbard get a lot of flack. So sports is another big thing. We've been for a very long time pushing for equal rights and access to discrimination-free healthcare and stuff like that. So general civil liberties that we've had to have kind of movements for in order to make some legal changes, like make things easier for us, because, you know, we've come up against this society where the rules aren't made to accommodate us at all. They're made to make sure that we don't exist because they're the context that, you know, they're made in. It's just like what you're saying about the policing of a binary system. So yeah, they're very much manifestations of that. You know, you see in the Western world a mirror of what happened with the gay rights movement. We're at the Think of the Children stage, so we're seeing education bills pop up, like what can parents do to keep their kids from learning about gender and sexuality in classes and stuff like that. That was kind of the last stronghold of the anti-gay movement was just think of the children's stuff, as well as, you know, things like panics about locker rooms and bathrooms and stuff like that. So, you know, that's kind of a positive thing that we're seeing, you know, and, you know, you can look at all of these issues and there's just this laundry list full of stuff everywhere about how, you know, we're just getting basically cemented as second-class citizens in a lot of places. But I think ultimately the trend is positive. So, you know, that's the kind of world we're facing today with, as trans people, one that's quite hostile to us in a lot of ways, but is also learning to accept us in its own way as well. And that's pretty quite an experience.
Yeah, one of the things that I think we're going to be going into a couple of times throughout this discussion is that a lot of contemporary transphobia is very much backlash. You know, there's been transphobia for decades, you know, at least a century and a half, depending how you define transphobia and transness. For a lot of the time, it's been background radiation transphobia. It's just standardized and people don't think about it. Whereas now that trans people have become so much more visible, even, you know, in the last 5 to 10 years, there have been huge leaps forward in terms of visibility. The sort of the almost negative side of visibility is that therefore you become more of a target, there's more of a backlash. So that's what we're starting to see is not so much background standard transphobia that people wouldn't even think about, but this kind of doubling down and backlash transphobia from particular communities kind of thing. And I also agree about think of the children stage, that the last vestiges of legal homophobia. Again, depending on how you define legal homophobia, you could say there are ways the legal system is still homophobic. But in terms of kind of explicit legal homophobia, you know, some of the last things on the books were sort of not banning homosexuality, but doing this kind of think of the children thing, where it was no longer acceptable to say that being gay was immoral. You know, obviously there were people who said that, but it was no longer sort of socially acceptable in mainstream politics. But what you could say is, well, we need to protect children from sort of things they don't understand. And I think the ugly side of that is they're talking about protecting children, but in practice they're actually victimizing queer and trans children by denying them access to information and support. And that I lived in the UK during a period when Section 28 was still on the books. I was in school. And so for people who don't know, Section 28 was probably the last really explicit piece of legal homophobia in the UK sort of law system. It was introduced by Thatcher. It's very similar to the sort of the Don't Say Gay legislation we're now seeing in the US, which is as much targeting trans people, or if not more so than gay people, actually. But in this case, it was this idea of not promoting homosexuality, and that teachers shouldn't promote homosexuality in schools. And of course, what that means in practice is that teachers couldn't be openly gay, they couldn't educate on gay issues or on homophobia. You know, my experience at that time, I wasn't aware that this was the law, but I was certainly aware of homophobia. I mean, even at that age, I was quite young, I was aware that the other kids were homophobic, and teachers might not have been overtly homophobic, but they didn't necessarily do anything about that. And it was this kind of stifled environment where you just couldn't really openly talk about these things. That was abolished, I think, in the late 90s, not long after I sort of was in school in that situation. It's the think of the children, protect the children language. And also, there's also the aspect of protecting cis women, which we're going to go into, the idea that cis women are especially vulnerable to trans women, despite the fact that, you know, trans women also face violence and face threats to safety, which are part of the reason trans women need access to certain spaces. The idea of protecting vulnerable populations is used. People say, oh, I'm not against trans people, but I care about safety for these groups. And it's a kind of really insidious way of sort of disguising the victimization of trans people. But we've sort of hinted at this already. What are the social forces behind these sorts of policy changes and, yeah, generally transphobic policies?
Well, like you said, there's like a, you know, a background radiation of transphobia, of transphobic sentiment, you know, if you wanted to go kind of even further, you could say it's just rooted in like fear of something that's different because you've been taught it's bad, or you've been taught that, you know, it's a sin or whatever to be gay. But, you know, obviously these movements aren't organic movements usually. So obviously when you have a minority trying to get rights, usually that is an organic movement because there's a will there for people, and then they organize amongst themselves. And then they, you know, try with legislation in a way that, you know, benefits them. Whereas, you know, when you look at movements like the TERFs from TERF Island, TERF standing for, you know, Trans Exclusionary Radical Feminist, which is basically just a feminist, in quotes, a feminist who just hates trans people. And, you know, they claim to stand up for women, like you said, but really their politics just boil down to really hating trans people. And, you know, the UK is the new hotbed of this anti-trans activism. That's why it's referred to as TERF Island sometimes. And that's where a lot of the impetus for this is coming from, as well as, you know, a healthy dash of, like, the far right, alt-right, in the United States, conservative lobby groups like the Heritage Foundation and stuff like that, they're all behind, you know, big pushes for anti-trans legislation and stuff like that in places where there are, you know, there's legislation to try and make trans people's lives easier. Like here, there was a amendment to an act that, you know, just allowed us to skip going to court and just make it a bureaucratic process to change your sex on your birth certificate. It was an amendment. It passed unanimously in Parliament. But, you know, there was a ton of money coming from somewhere, you know, funding this group called Speak Up for Women, who just got completely silent after, you know, after it was passed, basically. But you see it kind of evolving, and there's other groups that pop up. Like now there's the education one. So this new education group, actually definitely connected with people who were in that last group, Speak Up for Women, are going around providing resources to transphobic parents to try and basically do conversion therapy on their kids, which is really scary. That's a bad thing. And it, you know, it's got resources for schools and stuff as well. And yeah, it's in the wake of other legislation coming in through New Zealand that, you know, bans conversion therapy for, you know, gender identity and sexuality. A similar law was going to go through, or did go through in the UK, but they left the gender identity part out. Because this TERF activism is so active in the UK and it's been able to catch on a lot there, you know, it ended up affecting it. So these kind of movements, even though they're astroturf, they do have a lot of real life consequences for politics. And, you know, here they just haven't caught on. I'm hoping that they don't. But, you know, there's other places in the world where things are a little bit different. Like in Russia, you know, they've had anti-gay propaganda laws for quite a while now, since maybe 2013. Was that when they brought those in?
I think that's about right. One of the two times I've protested outside the Russian embassy.
Yeah. Well, anyway, they did that, and that stuff's got a similar tone to it, to the protecting children stuff. So it's a similar sort of thing, but it latches onto a different kind of cultural transphobia. So, you know, they go about it in a different way. But yeah, those are far right entities. You know, Orban in Hungary, who just got reelected, has brought through similar laws, even harsher, especially for transgender people who can't even change their name to a different gendered name. You have a list of approved names and they're gendered and you have to do it to your own birth sex. Shit like that's pretty scary, especially when, you know, a very similar Putinista bill goes through Romanian parliament. It's probably not going to pass, but it's been through one stage of it. And And it's basically, you know, a similar thing. It's the don't say gay thing. You're not allowed to talk about being gay or trans as if it's a benefit to you, or as if it's an integral part of your identity, or transitioning was a good thing. You're not allowed to say that. You're not allowed to talk about it in front of children. It's similar. They're trying to, there's a bit of hope that the right and that Turks have, I think, that they can push that sort of stuff in, because, you know, the Don't Say Gay bill did catch on in Florida, you know, and that's in the wake of some other terrible assaults on rights for gender minorities in the United States. That's the situation. It's pretty messy.
Obviously, we've touched on the TERF movement. It's important to sort of characterize that movement in terms of what it actually is politically. I've heard people say it's not feminist, and you said feminist in quotes. And I think it's an interesting history there in that it does have roots in sort of the radical feminism of the sort of the late 70s and 80s, which sort of distinguished itself from both liberal and socialist feminism, and basically that they, if you read their writing from the time, it's mixed. Some of it's explicitly transphobic, so the Transsexual Empire, and I think 1979 is a very early manifesto of TERFery, although it wasn't called that at the time. But there's a lot of writing from the radical feminist movement of that time, which just didn't talk about trans people. You know, trans people were just not a discussion point. What a lot of it was a very bio-essentialist view on women's oppression. Even then, it was that women's oppression is all to do with the body. It's rooted in the reproductive function, that patriarchy is about the reproductive sort of bodily functions. And there's a certain truth to that. I think they get it the wrong way round, in a sense that from a pro-trans feminist perspective, it's more about what's socially assigned to bodies. So, you know, there's functions that are assigned to cis women by patriarchy, but then there's also sort of functions that are assigned to trans women, and part of the fight for liberation is about defying that assignment. But they sort of tended to root it in bodies, and there were critiques at the time from socialist feminists that it was a bio-essentialist thing. It's evolved over the years, and I think, again, it's doubled down, and in the conflicts with other kind of strands of feminism, it just became more and more focused on essentially targeting trans women and targeting sex workers. Those became the two defining things. And whereas, say, abortion rights had been a really central pillar of it, that's kind of gone into the background, really, especially as they've started to make alliances with, you know, as you referenced, you know, conservative Christians, as well as other sort of far-right forces who are completely opposed to abortion rights. So that's no longer, although I'm sure any TERF would say, of course, they support abortion rights, it's no longer a central focus of their activism. They prioritize targeting trans women and sex workers and making alliances with more explicitly conservative forces against these marginalized groups. So, you know, I think that question of whether it's feminist is like an interesting one, because it has roots in a certain strand of feminism, but it's become so essentially focused on defending a certain kind of woman against essentially marginalized groups and making alliances with conservative forces to do that.
Yeah, I kind of feel like in a way it's making, saying that they're not real feminists is a little bit like feminists wiping their hands clean of something, possibly, you know, like being afraid to critique parts of the feminist movement that went astray
yeah.
in the 70s and 80s, which is really important to do, because, you know, if you want your social movement to actually be successful and consistent, then, you know, you do have to critique it. You do have to be like, where did we go wrong? Why did this not work in the way we wanted? Why is this strange-ass ideology just popped up out of nowhere? You can't say that's not really feminism. Kind of did it in a way. Well, you gave them fodder in a way, or your ideological forebearers had something to do with them, you know? So you've got to find where these ideas come from and how they've propagated, and that's really the difference between, you know, these people and the actual feminist movement. You know, there's always been feminist academics who have had a lot of stuff to say that is controversial, but I mean, like, do we consider feminist academics to be part of the feminist movement? Like, it's what do you even call a feminist anyway? So they're all ostensibly feminists. I'll grant it to them if they really want to. I'll just say, hey, you know, it's a little bit controversial, you guys calling yourselves feminists. Just letting you know. That's why I put scare quotes around it.
I think it's a bit like the arguments people have around who's a true socialist, where, you know, there's historically different strands that have called themselves socialist, you know, and I'm personally, I guess, more of a libertarian socialist, but certainly reformism has probably been the dominant kind of socialism that most people would think of, or Stalinism. So it's sort of like, in a way, saying, well, they're not true socialists. It's a bit of a no true Scotsman argument that doesn't consider that socialism has meant many things for a long time. And I think the point is, as you say, to critique it and almost to say, if that's feminism, it's not the kind of feminism that I stand for. In terms of the washing of hands, another thing is to consider whether feminist spaces in general were inclusive to trans women. Historically, it's probably, I'd say, even though TERFs are a very particular strand that have dug their heels in, it's only relatively recently that the broader feminist movement has become more inclusive of trans women. You know, so women's spaces for a long time were defined kind of biologically, but that has shifted. I mean, you know, when TERFs kind of say that they're defending things like, you know, rape crisis centers, things like that, actually a lot of them have become trans inclusive over the years. It might have been a struggle to get there, but now they operate in a trans-inclusive way. So the idea that TERFs are defending these spaces, which have already become trans-inclusive, again, it's this idea of protecting a vulnerable population, which is kind of a mask for actually perpetuating oppression. Yeah, do you have any more comments on that?
Yeah, I mean, like, about rape crisis centers and stuff like that, I feel like they get really nasty towards centers that have specifically trans-inclusive policies. So, if anything, they're a pain in the ass for rape crisis centers. Because, you know, the people, coordinators and stuff like that in charge of them get harassed just constantly by TERFs. They're constantly being harassed by TERFs, and then they can't do their work properly, you know? They have litigation put on them by TERFs. And it drains their resources, and then they can't work with any sexual assault victims at all, because they end up using resources to try and quell the storm that a few people are making. A few people are kicking up a storm, and you know it ends up actually damaging rape crisis centers mostly. It turns out they actually do not support rape crisis centers.
Yeah, again, like when they defend children, they're actually victimizing the people they claim to be defending. You mentioned that it's a very few people, and I think that's an interesting issue. Is like, certainly in Aotearoa New Zealand, as you've referenced, they haven't gotten quite the same sway that they have elsewhere. Like in the UK, there's a lot of liberals who've essentially been won over by their arguments, whereas here it's really a few very dedicated activists, and they are dedicated and they do have an impact, but they're relatively marginal. And I think that's kind of similar to, I mean, in general, the far right here is relatively marginal, but it's grown, and you know, there are very dedicated activists. Unfortunately, one of them is called Arnie, which offends me greatly. A local very dedicated TERF is called Arnie, yeah, which as I say, offends me a lot personally as an Arnie. How is this kind of experienced by trans people? So how is transphobia experienced? Again, a very broad question, but you know, what are the sort of main ways transphobia is experienced?
So I guess, like, it could be any of the, you know, any of the stuff that we're talking about, the policy issues and stuff that are affecting us, they have real life consequences. Can we use the bathroom in public? Can we get employment easy? You know, are we going to get fired because we want to transition? Can we get proper access to healthcare? All of that stuff that a lot of people don't really have to worry about in their day-to-day life, but we do have to worry about it, and we have to worry about it as well because people can't shut up about it. We're just talked about all the time nowadays. We're living through a time where a lot of us are kind of coming out of the woodwork, like we were talking about before. The backlash to our rights is a sort of revanchism, because what it used to be the way that, you know, when you transition, you would move to a different city, you'd go what they call stealth, and you would never bring up your past or, you know, the fact that you were trans at all. And we've seen a shift in attitude over the years towards one that's less pathologizing of transness, just like there was a shift between, you know, homosexuality as a disease to it's a, you know, just a sexuality. There's nothing, you know, wrong with it or pathological about it. And because of that, I think people are more okay about not moving to a different city where no one knows you're trans and just saying, I'm transgender, I hate this is my new name, that sort of stuff. And so because it's kind of, the conditions are warm enough for us to do that, we come up with a lot of backlash from, you know, people around us, like scorning looks and stuff like that. So, you know, if we might not, if we might stand out a lot, like wearing clothes of what might look to someone else as the opposite gender, they just see like a cross-dressing person. So they might have this visceral reaction, and it might be informed by stuff that they heard on the radio or on the news or something like that, but it will be combined with this, you know, kind of background radiation transphobia we were talking about. But it ends up in real life consequences to us too. We get harassed by people on the street, by people on the internet. You know, everywhere you go on the internet, there's hate towards trans people. We're a minority that's got a dog whistle specifically to tell us to kill ourselves, which is, what is it, like 45 or something? Something like that, 42? People just say 42 to you. And it's referencing this study where apparently 42% of transgender people surveyed said that they had attempted suicide. So they're just telling you to kill yourself when they say this number to you. And that's a pretty fucked up place to be. But like I said, you know, we're a lot more out of the woodworks now. A lot more people are coming out as trans as well. And the backlash and the media sensationalism makes a really hostile environment for us to be living in right now. And, you know, combining that with the structural legal stuff that, you know, ends up screwing with our lives, it's, yeah, there's a lot of material effects there for sure. But, you know, like, a lot of it goes on other elements as well. You know, there's a lot of people who can afford to transition very smoothly and have as much surgery as they want and, you know, never experience police violence. And, you know, they won't be exposed to, you know, racialized violence. So, like, white trans people, you know, even though we're not, we don't have it very well, you know, a black trans woman is, like, will probably be one of the most marginalized kind of, you know, people that will be out there. And so someone who's a black trans woman will be experiencing a lot more of what I just talked about compared to, like, what I would experience when I go out and try and, like, interact with the world.
Yeah, I think in Aotearoa, New Zealand, you know, much similarly, you know, Māori and Polynesian trans women in particular, you know, that much less likely to have, for example, access to employment than white trans women, and that much more likely to experience street violence. So that's certainly an international pattern for sure. I mean, I guess another dimension, we've been talking about the material effects, and I think another dimension is the kind of psychological effects. So I think, you know, I think it's one thing people have to understand is anything bad that you can say or think about trans people have thought themselves in large part because of that active transphobia. And people who are saying 40% yourself, I think they know, you know, they know that. They are deliberately setting out to trigger mental health attacks and suicidality. You know, people who aren't that quite that dedicated, I think have to understand that if you're well-intentioned, I think you have to understand that, as I say, anything negative you've thought about trans people have thought about themselves. One way this kind of manifests in public is the sort of co-optation of some trans people by the so-called gender critical movement, where you have sort of essentially binary trans people, because, you know, they'll be accepting of maybe binary trans people who've been able to transition and sort of acceptably present as their gender. This isn't all binary trans people, but it's a particular layer of more privileged binary trans people who essentially will perpetuate a lot of transphobia and target, you know, particularly in that context with the gender critical stuff, there's a lot of targeting of non-binary people, saying that non-binary people are just trans trenders, but also even people are binary and haven't had the same opportunities to transition, that will be cast as not being a real trans person because you don't present as your gender gender kind of thing. You know, those people who are co-opted into that gender critical thing also tend to perpetuate that quite dated view of transness, which you've referred to, which is the sort of pathologizing medical vision of transness. So, you know, they'll say that the defining thing about a transphobia is that it's a condition, it's a mental health condition, essentially, and it's about gender dysphoria, which is feeling that there's something wrong with your body. And instead of saying that, you know, that negative experience of being trans, you know, maybe has social determinants, that, like, you know, that the impacts of policy and of everyday transphobia and sort of social transphobia are a sort of negative feeling about yourself, they'll say that that's a medical condition. Again, much like with homophobia, as you said, where homophobia, the historical case for gay people was that they're experiencing a medical condition and therefore that it should be legal and treated. And for a long time, that's also been how trans people have been defended. That's kind of started to shift. And there's been a more sort of a positive view of transness as not just a mental health condition.
I guess, like, people will tolerate us as a disease, but they won't accept us as people with rights who are allowed to be, you know, actually not ashamed of ourselves, because that's where a lot of this, like, internalized transphobia comes from. It's just being ashamed of who you are, of your condition. You know, the way I look at it, I don't see it as a positive or a negative, really. I mean, the negative parts come from crap that you face because of it. There's a world out there where I transitioned and it was just fine. I could just do it and it just helped me. And, you know, I didn't experience so much negative stuff from it. Because we do, there's a tendency for some people to, you know, express that in some very bad ways, including, you know, being sucked in by this, like, quote unquote gender critical, because I can't say seriously that these people are critical of gender. I can maybe call them feminists. Gender critical is a stretch.
They're in favor of the gender binary, really. Like, so it's a bizarre self-designation. But yeah, they're TERFs.
Yeah, and so are these trans people. These trans people are TERFs, but because they're trans, people call them trans medicalists.
Yeah.
So they're like, yeah, we've got this disease, we're being treated for it. Gender dysphoria is a real condition, and a lot of you are actually just faking having it.
Yeah.
And you're making it a lot worse for us by looking weird, basically, is their main thing. But it's really, really obvious that they just hate themselves, and it's sad. It's really sad, and I can see it. I guess it's obvious to me because I feel that too. You know, I don't go as far as they do with expressing it in such a negative way, but I definitely feel all that negativity where that comes from.
Yeah, I mean, one concept in terms of a positive or negative, I agree, it's not really either. It's just part of, you know, the spectrum of being human. But one concept that's come up recently in sort of pro-trans circles is gender euphoria, that transness doesn't just involve dysphoria, it also involves euphoria. And I've certainly experienced that where sometimes when I present in a femme way and that's it's affirmed, it can be this euphoric thing. And I think that they're two sides of the same coin. It's not to say transness doesn't involve dysphoria, more that it can involve both things, you know, whereas, I mean, I tend to present as more masc in daily life, and I certainly experience dysphoria related to that. And I, you know, when I said that the things that you think about us are things that we've thought about ourselves, you know, certainly I buy into a lot of the time the idea that because I present as masc, therefore I'm not truly trans, even though I don't identify as a woman, I identify as non-binary, even then, you know, which doesn't necessarily imply femme, but like, but because I present as masc, you know, I think I'm not read by a lot of people as truly under the trans umbrella. I'm certainly capable of thinking that myself. You know, an anecdotal example of this, which is about a friend of mine, and, you know, if you're listening, you know, this isn't personal. It's just an example of this thing that I think most of us have internalized in some way. It was having a fairly honest discussion with someone, and they kind of ask, if you're non-binary, you know, why do you present that way, was basically what they asked. I kind of showed them my Facebook profile picture, which is me dressing up as a particular character, Magenta in Rocky Horror. And that was, you know, it was a successful, like, performance. And because they saw that picture, they were like, they understood it more and they were fine with it. But I think that to me is how that sort of idea of legitimately versus illegitimately trans is sort of defined, where, you know, where if you successfully pass or present as agenda, then that's considered, in some circles at least, is considered legitimate, whereas if you don't present that way, it's, you know, you're faking it and maybe you just want access to spaces kind of thing, and that it's not, you know, that it's not a real legitimate thing. And I think that's part of the targeting of particularly non-binary people, but then also binary trans people who haven't had access, as you say, to the resources to fully transition the way they might kind of thing, might like to. All of that is also internalized by trans people. Yeah, do you have any more comments on sort of the experience of transphobia?
The transphobia that non-trans people experience.
Mm.
So cisgender people who are non-conforming, you know, people who might identify as the gender they were born with, are often the target of a lot of these people as well. So the stuff like bathroom bills affect them too, because, you know, who's going to get singled out in bathrooms to get enforced this law? It's people who don't look like you'd expect it. And so that leaves cisgender, gender non-conforming people in a tight predicament. It's kind of like TERFs will use them as a thing, you know, saying, you know, it's okay to be gender non-conforming, just be a man or a woman that dresses differently or whatever, or present differently. It's okay to have androgynous features and have an androgynous body or whatever. But when push comes to shove, it's really not okay. They advocate for policies and for laws that make it not okay to do things outside of this realm. So I find it so laughable that they call themselves gender critical.
Well, their claim is that there's that sex is real, but gender isn't. But then that ultimately means they're actually supporting the gender binary. I mean, I know cis people who've been harassed in bathrooms because, you know, somebody considered they must be trans because of how they present. And we've also seen there's a whiteness to it as well, where the way people understand, like, truly cisgender femininity is generally white. So we've seen, particularly in sports, there's been harassment of cis women who aren't white but who have a body that is considered not, you know, that not to live up to true cisgender norms, and they're not trans, but people just make, I guess, a mistake in quotes. I mean, when I say a mistake in quotes, you know, they might genuinely think that the person is trans, but it's ultimately a result of their very simplistic understanding of gender, that, you know, that these people don't conform to their understanding of what a cis person is supposed to look like. Very famous example with Caster Semenya. There was a medical aspect to that, but you also see it every so often, you know, Twitter or something, get negative comments about a woman who's actually cisgender in sports but who doesn't conform to their image of what a cisgender woman is supposed to look like. How is transphobia present in pop culture, as well as transness? How is transness present in pop culture?
Generally as a joke.
Mm.
Traditionally as a joke.
Mm.
So, you know, there's been a lot of tropes over the last few decades in TV and movies and stuff like that. Trans woman who looks really mannish, who it's like, you know, it's laughable that people could ever see her as a woman, sort of thing. Then there's the kind of the femme fatale, super hyper femme passing trans woman who, you know, you could never guess was trans, and she had a bunch of surgeries done and then now is doing something evil like crime, or she did it to run away from her old identity or something like that, and seducing someone and basically ends up being killed. Or a serial killer who's really, really deranged. Those are three classic transsexual tropes in media. You see stuff moving away from that sort of stuff. So how pop culture a lot of the times will mirror the conditions and how people feel towards something. A lot of the old kind of crude transphobic jokes and stuff like that aren't as funny anymore to a lot of people, because people have a level of awareness and understanding of transgender people that renders those jokes unfunny, basically. They've got an understanding that's evolved beyond that. So now, as people are aware of transgender issues and stuff like that, and we're still used as jokes a lot, we might have possibly a more positive or sympathetic portrayal. But, you know, it will seem positive and sympathetic to us now. but in a while probably won't. It's a different sort of beast, and I think it's come with the recent wave, or like transgender tipping point, as people put it, post Laverne Cox being in Orange Is the New Black, and that kind of representation and Sense8 and stuff like that kind of bent it a little bit, having some positive portrayal kind of skewed a little bit better. There's still transphobic jokes. Like I said, though, they're a little bit different. As an example, you see Family Guy. Terrible show. I don't like the show, but
Yeah, fuck Seth MacFarlane and the employee.
Yeah, so Quagmire's dad, in quotes, is a transgender woman who in one of the episodes transitions, and is a punchline in a joke where Brian gets really, really drunk, sleeps with her, and then gets told that she was trans, and the joke is Brian vomiting for like 2 minutes or something like that. And he doesn't stop vomiting. It's just a stream of vomit because he had been intimate with a trans woman who he presumably found sexy beforehand. So the thought was just so disgusting, and that was that. And then, fast forward years later, you've got the same character, Quagmire's mother, who's transgender. She's sitting at a bar browsing pornography, and the barkeep says, hey, you're not allowed to watch porn in here. And she says, it's all right, I'm trans. And then the barkeep says, okay, that's all right, you can do whatever you want to then. The joke there being that now, because of these laws where we're getting a lot of, reactionary backlash from, we have all sorts of special protections. That means where, we've got like special allowances in society, and that we're allowed to do whatever we want to do, which is funny in a way, but not in the way that they wanted it to be funny.
And that it's kind of the opposite of the case.
That's kind of where we're at with the crude humor. Crude humor can't be as crude as it was before, but then you see people like, Dave Chappelle get up on stage and basically state political opinion as a joke. I don't know if we count that as comedy, but yeah, it's definitely pop culture. So that there's a very political element to it at the moment. And I feel like maybe there didn't used to be so much when it was just laughing at us or feeling sorry for us.
Yeah, again, I think with a sort of recurring theme of background radiation transphobia, where people probably didn't even think about transphobic jokes, but now because of the, the progress that has been made, we have this kind of backlash transphobia and doubling down transphobia. Obvious prominent examples being Dave Chappelle, Ricky Gervais, J.K. Rowling. All people have been criticized for their transphobia and have sort of doubled down and made it a part of essentially their brand, that they are defending their right to be transphobic, essentially. In the case of Dave Chappelle, saying that he's Team TERF, which, as you say, is just expressing a political opinion, apparently as a joke. So Rowling, for example, has become one of the really leading figures for TERFery worldwide, which brings us to one question that's come up a lot. What do you think of the whole separating the art from the artist concept that's been in circulation? Rowling being an obvious example, where a lot of our generation are huge Harry Potter fans.
Yeah, I think it's contextual in the Rowling sense. I think it's very hard to, especially at the moment, because, she's still alive. She's still saying all this stuff that's really, really harmful, and buying her stuff and buying into her products is in a way supporting her saying that.
Yeah.
But, at the same time, I don't think that I wouldn't, go out telling people that they can't like Harry Potter if they want to. A lot of people have very complicated feelings towards it. And I really understand. But yeah, I don't think you can with, Rowling. Let's say Seth MacFarlane made some stuff that was actually good.
But there is a debatable case about the Orville, which I might talk about once you've wrapped up this point. But in terms of Seth MacFarlane,
I think personally I'd be able to give it not a pass, but a like I wouldn't defend someone for making a transphobic joke. But if someone makes a crude transphobic joke, like in a TV show, it's not going to rule that show completely out for me. what will make me really ick about a show is probably if I've watched enough of it to really understand a lot of the subtext to it, and that would make me uncomfortable. Yeah. Just having like a few crude jokes, I think I'd be able to separate some art and be like, okay, this guy obviously is not educated, but he probably isn't trying to be so malicious with this. Whereas with someone like Graham Linehan, you know, if he made anything that didn't have anything to do with trans people, I'd be like, yo, fuck this guy. Why are you like giving him money now?
Yeah.
And that's my kind of position on the issue.
Yeah, I think there's always problematic art. Your fave is always problematic. I think, as you say, a lot of it comes down to if people are really politically dedicated to transphobia, if they're making that a large part of their sort of public presence, then financially supporting them is not great. That doesn't mean that you have to purge, as you say, everything that might have some problematic aspect. You can enjoy things that might be problematic critically, but always consider whether you're materially supporting, you know, transphobic figures. I think that kind of the distinction, I think, as you say. I'm interested now to go into, I guess, complicated cases, because Seth MacFarlane, you said if he did something that wasn't transphobic, and I think the Orville, the first season, has a really interesting example of a well-intentioned but kind of confused take on transness. So the episode is that there's a society that is supposedly entirely male. There's a baby born with sort of what's considered female genitalia. And the episode, I've heard other people under this trans umbrella say that they like the episode, so this is just my personal take on it. But I thought it was incredibly confused, because basically what happens is that the members of the Orville, which is kind of this utopian Star Trek-y kind of society, they make a case for recognizing this baby as female, which is kind of bizarre because it's a baby and they're making a case on the basis of its genitalia. So they seem to think that they're making a case for trans rights. We would probably understand that more as similar to, say, an intersex baby. And in the case of an intersex baby, we don't know what they identify as yet. We would oppose corrective surgery, but what happens in the episode is that they end up defending women's rights and sort of making this case that women can be strong. And it's like, but we don't know if this baby is a woman. We just know that they have genitalia that's unusual for that society. So they make this really confused case for women's rights on the basis of a baby's genitalia, and they sort of confuse intersex issues, trans issues, and women's rights broadly, even, you know, cis women's rights. And it is very confused, and I think well-intentioned. It's a case of that some of the more progressive things happening now are still going to be imperfect. You sort of referenced that some of the best things now we might not think is great are in a few years' time. That is definitely the case, and that kind of segues into something I want to talk about, which is the whole product of its time argument, which you also get with somewhat older text. And I think it's important to understand that if something's a product of its time, then actually any time period is probably more complex than people realize it is. So, like, right now we obviously have transphobic media. You could say it's a product of its time. You could also say the pro-trans media is a product of its time, and, you know, in 10 years people are going to make the same defense of the transphobic material, that it was a product of its time. And the historical cases are also much more complex than I think people realize. So I wanted to give one example, which is Silence of the Lambs, which is a really classic example of basically a text that's been criticized by trans people. So for people who don't know, there's a serial killer in it, Buffalo Bill, who is victimizing cis women, taking parts of their body in order to essentially present as a woman. The weird thing about that is that the movie actually goes out of its way, very briefly, but does go out of its way to say that this character is not a true transsexual, which I think is interesting, because even, you know, even in the 90s, which people would say, oh, it was a product of its time, they knew enough about transness to put in this disclaimer, this person isn't really trans, which obviously shows that they knew about transness and this wasn't just a purely ignorant thing, so that they put this disclaimer, which wasn't good enough because it's a period where you didn't really have positive representation of trans people. So the closest thing you have to a representation of a trans person is a serial killer, and they just put on this disclaimer that they're not really trans. In terms of the time period, there were people who were critical of it, and you can say that for pretty much any time over the past, you know, how however many decades that there were trans activists criticizing this kind of material. So I'm just going to quote from a pamphlet which was published at the time. So a pamphlet by Leslie Feinberg called Transgender Liberation, A Movement Whose Time Has Come, in 1992. So towards the end of the pamphlet, it says, transgender people are the brunt of cruel jokes on television and in films. Movies like Psycho, Dressed to Kill, and Silence of the Lambs create images of transgender people as dangerous sociopaths. In Silence of the Lambs, a sort of transvestite wannabe transsexual kills women and skins them in order to sew a woman's body for himself. It's interesting that Leslie Feinberg uses he pronouns there, but I think is probably in reference to that point that the movie makes, that this isn't a true trans person. But to continue the quote, the film turns reality upside down. It is actually transvestites and transsexuals who have been the victims of grisly murders. This point was driven home by activists who disrupted the National Film Society Awards in spring 1992. They passed out flyers highlighting the real-life murder of transsexual Venus Extravaganza, who appeared in the documentary Paris is Burning. Extravaganza was murdered before the film on Harlem's Drag Balls was finished. Silence of the Lambs swept the Academy Awards. Paris is Burning wasn't even nominated, close quote. So that really shows that even if it was a product of its time, that was a time when trans people existed and were represented in some kinds of media, but this was marginal media. So Paris is Burning, as this pamphlet says, wasn't really recognized. It's kind of had a new lease on life recently as trans people have started to make more strides in terms of representation. That film has sort of been rediscovered in a way and circulated a bit more.
There's no correlation in the literature between transsexualism and violence. Transsexuals are very passive.
Have a go. Billy is not a real transsexual, but he thinks he is. He tries to be. He's tried to be a lot of things, I expect.
Going back even earlier, an example that interests me in terms of being, quote, a product of its time, close quote, is Life of Brian, which is very much an example of a kind of comedy representation of a trans woman. The interesting thing is it's the movie Life of Brian is kind of satirizing left-wing spaces. This is after the sort of joke about splitters and the People's Front of Judea and all that, which is often quoted. There's a sequence where someone is basically one of the activists keeps bringing up rights for women. Somebody asks, why do you keep bringing up? And this is a sort of male-presenting person, and they say, because I want to be one. So then you have John Cleese as the kind of leader of the group shutting this person down, being incredibly rude, saying that they can't really be a woman. I mean, it's ambiguous in some sense in that John Cleese is kind of supposed to be a jerk. He always plays a snooty jerk in Monty Python stuff. So there's a question of whether we're actually supposed to agree with him here. Yeah, the trans woman is really shut down. You know, looking up a clip of this, I saw in comments people saying, oh, this predicted the future. You know, in the 70s, they knew what would be happening now, which is absurd because actually it was reflecting the time, because trans people existed in activist spaces. For this film, which is satirizing the left, whether sympathetically or not, it was reflective of the fact that trans activists existed. So when you say something's a product of its time, you have to actually recognize that that time period was probably more complex than you realize, and trans people did exist and were advocating for their rights at that time as well.
Furthermore, it is the birthright of every man
or woman.
Why don't you shut up about women, Stone? You're putting us off.
Women have a perfect right to play a part in our movement, Reg.
Why are you always on about women, Stan?
I want to be one.
What?
I want to be a woman. From now on, I want you all to call me Loretta.
What?
Yeah, do you have any thoughts on that?
No, I think you laid it out pretty good. It's a bit of a thought-terminating cliche to say that something's a product of its time.
Yeah.
You can use it like that. But also you can use it as a springboard for discussion about the time, too. So it depends on how you say it.
The only time I can sort of half buy that excuse is when people were at the most radical edge of the time period. They were dated in some respect. For example, if you read Leslie Feinberg's work, you know, some of the language is dated. Leslie Feinberg was, you know, the best of that time, essentially. And that's pretty much the only time I buy that excuse. But I also agree, you can take things as symptomatic and you can use them to understand the time period. That should be, as you say, it should be a springboard for talking about it rather than just excusing it and not thinking about it. There's so many examples, obviously, we could go into, but one documentary I'd really recommend is Disclosure, which Laverne Cox played a big part in. It goes into various cases throughout media. It's a very interesting documentary. Controversial point, which I think we'll discuss. It's on Netflix, which obviously also hosted Dave Chappelle's transphobic special, among other things. So do you have any comments about Netflix and the sort of transness and transphobia?
I guess Netflix is just gonna do what it's gonna do, right? It's a business, so they're gonna make themselves money when they can, and usually it's from what they can get. So, I mean, if Dave Chappelle's specials sell, then they're gonna, you know, keep putting on the transphobic Dave Chappelle special. If they can keep some sort of audience on that will watch documentaries about trans representation in media, they'll have a really, you know, weird target market, but, you know, maybe they can have two separate markets if they want to. It's capitalism, you know, they can do whatever the fuck they want. They don't have to stand by any values or anything, you know.
Yeah, they want to maximize audience appeal, and that includes appealing to trans people and people who are willing to see positive representation of trans people, but also appealing to transphobes and giving Dave Chappelle multiple specials. But we're now starting to see with the backlash and with Netflix starting to lose money that they seem to be dropping some content from diverse creators. So that period of playing both sides may be passing, although I'm sure they'll want to continue to profit off whoever they can profit off, you know, whether they're regardless of what community or what politics they're in. Recently watched quite a good video by Council of Geeks, which is about why has queer representation been so slow to progress in movies. You know, they made the point corporations are amoral, not immoral. In other words, and in particular when it comes to representation, you know, they might do the right thing for the wrong reasons, and they'll also happily do the wrong thing. In either case, it's because they want profit, because they want to maximize audience share. Essentially, the politics of representation are incidental to them because, you know, all that ultimately counts is the bottom line, obviously. So basically, queer and trans people, positive representation of us is only useful to them insofar as it's profitable, and if it's not, they'll drop it.
Kind of like our survival is like people depends on our ability to make ourselves a target market.
Pretty much. Last year's Pride Month episode, I talked about a show, Huge, by what was then, when it was released, called ABC Family. I forget what the network is called now. And it was a one-season show that was dropped. And actually, it was really ahead of, you could say ahead of its time, but really good in terms of representation. This was released in 2010. It was set at a fat camp with, you know, so it had a majority plus-size cast. You know, it had a character who was in early stages of figuring out their gender, played by Harvey Guillen, who's recently earned very belated recognition with What We Do in the Shadows. And he's a gay actor, but his character was sort of seemingly gender fluid and would alternately identify as Alistair or Athena. And unfortunately, you know, because it was cancelled after one season, we didn't get to see that story unfold and the character figure themselves out. And it was a case of, you know, ABC Family was experimenting, bringing on a younger audience, so they trialed out a bunch of shows and dropped the ones that weren't as profitable. So it was very much, and like for the time, very progressive show. You know, it wasn't profitable, so it was dropped. And that's where representation is good insofar as it will make them money. Capitalism, good times.
Disclosure was a show, it will be dropped.
Yeah, I mean, considering what's happening with Netflix, it looks like they're turning heel a little bit. Not that they weren't somewhat heel previously. I think they're battening down the hatches a bit. You know, we've discussed a lot of quite grim material, obviously. But what is to be done?
What is to be done? Stay safe, be safe, and treat people good. If I say those are two things to do, just in general. In terms of pop culture, what we need to do is we need to stop getting people who aren't trans playing trans characters. That's not going to solve everything and all of the problems with the writers, the directors, but, you know, that too. We got to get some more trans directors and trans writers in the writing rooms. You know, like I said, that's not going to solve everything, but You know, it's a really good start. For so long, we've not even been able to play ourselves or share our stories properly or write from our perspectives. That's something that would benefit pop culture a lot. Would benefit everyone, not just us. Yeah, and in terms of opposing rad femmes, fuck TERFs. Make sure that they don't get influence in your area, and if someone seems like they're kind of slipping down that rabbit hole, treat it like they're slipping down an alt-right or like an anti-vax rabbit hole, because there's the Venn diagram is very circle-shaped with those people.
Obviously, it's a fight on multiple fronts. There has certainly been steps forward just in the last 10 years, but it's certainly there's a lot of fights on our horizon to hold on to what we have and to move on potentially further than that. Thanks for coming on the show.
No worries. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for listening, everyone. If you like what we do, please contribute to our Patreon at patreon.com/jetpack1917. That obviously helps us pay the bills. Good night and good luck.
To play us out, here's Fantasy by Hybrid Rose.
I could be cute, I could be soft, I could be nothing, I could be a lot. You could turn me on, you could turn me off, but I won't self-destruct. 'Cause I'm a microchip and a machine, I can transform into what you want me to be, a psychokinetic entity. You will never get to me. Transform into what you want me to be, a psychokinetic entity. You will never get to meet me, baby. I am just your fantasy, a figment of your reality. I'll become your ultimate fantasy, fantasy. Get to me.